I had a professor who basically said, you know, the first time I did fine, I didn't love it, but did fine. But I can see the potential to become amazing at this and find ways to do this sometimes and do some stuff in person, some stuff online. So he said, I actually want to do it 2 more times. He said, first time is try it, hate it, but try it. Second time is try to improve on it and figure it out. Third time is ace it. Right. So it's sort of like a lot of things I find that actually work in education. And so at year 3, he said, you're right. Actually, I've got this mastered now, but it took me that long.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones, sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tiffany with the Digital to Learn podcast, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hey, Brad.
Hello, hello.
This is part 2 with our friend Andy Chan of Wake Forest. Welcome back, Andy.
Hey there. Hi, Tiffany. Hi, Brad.
So moving to that conversation of online, what does career services look like for the online learner, the online career services office, the online academic, and the relationship that those three persons share?
Very, very interesting and a great question. And I think a lot of people wonder about sort of, you know, how does the future look? And what I do think is we have to accept in higher education, there are a lot of different types of schools. There's a difference between a very, very large 50 to even up to 100,000 person state school and a school that's a small liberal arts school that has 1,000, 1,500 or 2,000 people. And sometimes what we do is we lump as sort of consumers or, you know, observers outside the system think we're all the same. We all do the same thing. We all educate students. And so, but the reality is the way that the experiences is very, very different. So
right.
It doesn't mean that every school has to do the same thing. And that actually, you know, and what's interesting is that there are different price points for these different mm-hmm. products. And so we just have to accept that and understand that they're just different choices people might have. If we go specifically then to like this online, more online environment and a student who might be in an online environment, of which actually this is another thing I think a lot of us know or maybe don't, but that, you know, the world of education is shifting such that the number of students who are being educated between 18 and 22 is actually a small percent of all the students who are out there getting sort of higher education. You know, there are many students who, for whatever reason, didn't do it in that age bracket or actually started but didn't finish it, but they want to finish it later. And so schools are doing all different kinds of things through their schools of professional studies, schools of continuing studies, through their graduate programs to be able to offer new ways of, and more ways of getting educated. And I think that's a good thing. What's interesting also is companies are even getting in that space where they're going to do that for their own employees or in partnership with universities. But I think that from a career support standpoint, for a sort of a traditional undergraduate student in the 18 to 22 year old range who hasn't worked much and who is trying to sort of navigate the beginning of their careers, the most interesting and important challenge is that if you are going to do it online, in general, a student has got to have a lot of self-initiative and motivation. They don't have the ability to have a cohort of friends who they're walking to class with to and from every day to talk about it, to mm-hmm. see that there are a bunch of people doing things like me. Oftentimes they're very alone. So that is one thing, which is I think those students have to have that motivation, as well as there maybe have to be things within the system that motivate them to want to complete and want to go through it. And so when I think about from a career standpoint, we have a very interesting model that we created that's sort of a version of what a lot of people will talk about when you do career development. And we call it the Wake Forest Ready 7. And it's basically 7 competencies areas that students need to master to be career and life ready. The first 5 are really about the job search process and making sure like you're really doing that in a thorough way. The first step is about understanding yourself, self-assessment. And the second step is understanding the market assessment. One of the things that's challenging about this process is most students, when they come to it, the first thing they're thinking is, I want a job or internships, and I don't want to do a lot of work to get one. I just want to get one. And so the challenge with that is that, you know, you don't really know yourself that well. You don't really know the market that well. you could find yourself trying to get something that you're not qualified or ready to get, or that the market, if you actually knew the job, you'd say, oh, I don't really want to do that. That's not what I saw on TV that they do. This is not, you know, that's the thing, is that you ask most students, they know 10 or so jobs, and they're mostly things that are around them that they've seen in their lives or on TV, when there's so many more choices. So that's sort of the first two steps. And then there's a third step, which is about your personal brand. Like, how do you represent yourself in the world professionally? And that includes your LinkedIn profile, your Handshake profile, your resume, your even your social media profiles matter when you start to think about getting a job, because employers oftentimes will do a little search on your name on Instagram or on Facebook, and just to see, what are you posting there? And if they don't really like what they see, that could be a knockout punch right there. And so just being aware of that's really important. The third step is actually, or fourth step, relationship and network. Relationship building and networking. The majority of jobs in the world are actually secured through networking and through knowing someone. And so I know a lot of people would say, well, I don't really know that many people, or maybe my family doesn't have those kinds of connections. And I think that is one of the areas that, thankful for systems like LinkedIn or like Handshake, that actually open up doors to connections with people. And the main thing is that, back to what I said earlier about having to have a bit of courage, I was reading a quote, and I put it in my Career Services Must Die Part 2 talk of, courage is being willing to let go of the familiar. And if you actually, you know, what's familiar to us is that I know my five friends and they don't know anyone, so I can't get anything. But the unfamiliar is, there's someone on LinkedIn who I don't know, but I can write an email in a professional and kind way that they might actually want to talk to me. And so anytime we hear stories about students who actually found that connection and wrote that story in a way that opened a door, that is the kind of thing you'd like every person to actually get comfortable with, and then know how to then build a relationship that then might lead to an opportunity, as opposed to, you know, many young people want to just put, like, I need a job, can someone help me? No, on a LinkedIn post, I'm looking for this, who can help me get it? And that's not usually the easiest way to actually get help. So we actually need to help students understand that. And the final one is actually interviewing. And so if you think about it, the stages are sort of knowing yourself and knowing, like, the direction you're headed, making sure you're presenting yourself in a way that people would want to actually talk to you, and then finding a way to actually be successful when you have an engagement and talking to someone who could hire you. Each of those steps are really important. And so I think in an online environment, we need to think through, what's the way we can provide that to students so that it is educational in nature, as opposed to it's just counseling in nature. So, because when you do it in counseling in nature, it's always one-to-one. And the hard part with that is it's hard to scale that. And that is one of the things that I talk about a bit, is that if we think that the way to get to successful career outcomes and career readiness for students is we just need to hire more counselors in the world, that's probably not going to work. Most schools are not going to say, I'm going to hire, you know, hundreds of counselors for my thousands of students. That I have only so much resource that I can dedicate to it. So we have to find scalable ways to do that. And I do think there are some great online courses that are in development. One of the things that actually we're doing at Wake Forest is that we developed a partnership with Kaplan. Kaplan provides a lot of services for universities beyond just what you think of as traditional test prep. And one of the services that we're working on with them is offering a way for schools to be able to provide more career advising for their students if they're to supplement what they already have and with expertise that they don't already have. And then also, we're taking the career courses that we developed at Wake Forest and enabling them to be offered to students at other schools, so that those students could actually get the same kind of content and educational material that we have at Wake Forest, to help those students learn the appropriate academic process to be able to learn this ready seven steps that I just described. So I do think that's really important. The last thing that they have as a component of that is being able to offer certifications that help students get additional market-based certifications that make them more appealing to employers.
Great.
So a lot of times you don't learn all that in the classroom, given the degree that you had. So if you actually get this extra certification, that can be really helpful too.
So to what extent do you find colleges and universities adapting to the new technology as part of what they do? And then secondly, listening to what employers have to say about what they want, and then adapting the curriculum to meet those needs or those preferences?
It depends, again, type of school. Sorry, that is the first answer. But I would say that, so technology adoption, I think, is being forced upon us through COVID. And I think that is going to help. I think what's challenging at any university is that university essentially is a usually very diffused, decentralized place that has a lot of fragmented groups and individual people, faculty and staff, who are all doing things in their own kind of way. And so because of that, it's hard to make it sort of operate like it's a company where everyone's doing the same thing and has to sort of follow all the same processes. So I do think that's one of the reasons why technology adoption can be slower than what you would like in general. I do think that, though, right now, this area around online teaching has accelerated dramatically. It's interesting. I was talking to a couple of our professors at Wake Forest, and they said, you know, when I first heard that we were going to have to do this, I was angry. I was really mad because it goes really against my instincts about teaching in the classroom. And I realized I don't have a choice. So now I'm going to do it. And so now that they've started to do it, and one of the things that I will definitely give props to Betsy Barr, who leads our whole teaching and learning sort of area. Mm-hmm. She brought together pods of faculty to work in learning groups and peer groups to work with each other. And so what happened is that those who were more advanced helped encourage the others who weren't quite as advanced. They're sharing best practices. So the learning is very accelerated. And then what has happened is that I had a professor who basically said, you know, the first time I did fine, you know, great professor, really personable. Didn't love it, but did fine. But I can see the potential to become amazing at this and find ways to do this sometimes and do some stuff in person, some stuff online. So he said, I actually want to do it two more times. He said, first time is try it, hate it, but try it. Second time is try to improve on it and figure it out. Third time is ace it. Right. So it's sort of like a lot of things I find that actually work in education. I had this rule of three. I talked to the former dean of the business school at Wake Forest, who was also new at the time. He's like, you know, Andy, this is hard work because I can't get changes to happen quickly because I have to wait like a whole nother year to have the changes that I want to do last fall to happen this fall. I said, that's the year, you know, sort of year three, you will have it figured out. And so at year three, he said, you're right. Actually, I've got this mastered now, but it takes me that long. And that's a little frustrating because, you know, you want to do things more quickly.
How do you and your team work together with faculty in a truly collaborative way, play nice with one another? Because if I reflect back to 2013, I recall some faculty being, you know, sending out an SOS, help me, someone from career come in and help these students. And then sometimes faculty would say, we want nothing to do with career development because we are industry experts and we have our networks and that's what we're here for. So I don't know if you come across the different levels of openness, but I'm just curious what you've done with that.
Yeah, for sure. There are many different ways. And I think one of the things that I think is really important is that, like you described, there are people across the entire spectrum. We don't generalize, you know, all faculty do one thing or all faculty don't do one thing. Like, it's just amazing how every person is an individual, every department is very unique and different. So that's both the benefit and the challenge. And what I like to do is, in general, try to go and find the people who are who have sort of bought into the idea that this is really important and we can work together. Even if they've done it on their own, then actually we can learn from them and we might be able to find things that they're doing that could help us and we could actually spread to other departments too. One is that if you have faculty or departments where they don't think they need you or want you, I think the main thing is just to be able to say, here are the kinds of things that we're doing with your students and here's what they're telling us that they need. We could actually help them with your help and we could do it together. That's actually one where I think the common thing that we all have is we want our students to be successful. We want to figure out how to actually reduce the amount of stress and burden on students because oftentimes they are very stressed because of the workload or other anxieties in life. And so if we share that, let's figure out how to do that together or quasi together if it's not totally perfect. The other thing is sometimes what we'll do is if we can, we'll try to figure out, are there alums out there who are from those departments who have had good experience with our department or are actually navigating their way in the world, and asking them to come back and speak to students? And can we do that together? You know, can we find that way? Because I think then that's actually even the better connection, is when the faculty see, wow, these were my students just 2 years ago, and I can't believe they're doing this now. This is really interesting for me to learn about. And how do we do that? We've also found one of the fun things is that when we have the time to be able to sit down with some of the faculty members and show them how we can find some of their former students on LinkedIn. We've had some of those professors say, can you help me with my LinkedIn profile so I can reach out to those students?
I'm sure.
Because those alums now actually both are doing interesting things, that there might be some research opportunities. And even for some of our faculty, they might even want to donate back to our department, because they were like, you know, we really liked each other back at school. And so I do think that it's almost like opening up new doorways for faculty to see that. The last thing we want to do, though, is to ask the faculty to do the work of the career office and to ever feel that way. And so I oftentimes with our own teams talk about doing this in stages, where part of what has to happen is you have to build a relationship slowly. And then over time, that turns into really amazing things. So I oftentimes, for a lot of different things, for, you know, relationship management, project management, go slow to go fast. Take your time, and then amazing things start to happen. And it always probably feels longer than you would have liked, but that's what was required to make that happen. There's actually a really neat Netflix video that a friend of mine shared with me called My Octopus Teacher. And if you watch it, it actually is about the relationship between a man and an octopus, that is about this idea of how do you build a relationship with someone who's very different from you. And so whether, you know, career services is the octopus or the faculty of the octopus, the reality is that we're very different and we have to take time to get to know each other.
That's a great example. So, Andy, make some predictions for us about the next 10 years in the whole career field.
There's a few big things that I think will occur. So one, the education industry as a whole is going to go through a lot of change. I think everyone has talked about that for a while. I do think that COVID is accelerating everything, and I think it's going to accelerate it in education. One of the things that a lot of universities have struggled with is just the general business model of education. All of our infrastructure costs and our fixed costs tend to sort of stay and rise. And we're trying to figure out how to control tuition and not make it exorbitant. And so I do think that at some level, there's going to be a certain set of schools who are, as they already are now, sort of the premium price type schools. And then there are others who are not. And I think people are going to have to discern for themselves, like, what am I really trying to buy and what do I really want? So I do think that's going to continue. And I think a lot of people would rather have it be like, can't we just get it to be the price is all the same? But I would describe it a little bit more almost like the car market, right? So there's some cars you can get entry level and get in, and then you maybe work your way up and pay more later. And I do think that there's some that it costs a lot right from the get-go. And so the one benefit, though, I will say that we should be really aware of is that the retail price of education is not the same as the actual real price. You know, what people are publishing aren't the same, because there's a lot of philanthropic dollars and other money provided for scholarships, so that it's worth any student to actually even look at the expensive thing, because they might be able to get an amazing deal if they go through the process. So I do think, I know it creates a burden on the student to have to do that, but like I said, think boldly and try, even if you might think that that price seems so high. Second thing is that I do think that schools will be continuing to push, as you guys are, you know, talk about on this podcast, is that it to be as digital as possible. I do think, again, it's going to come across in lots of different kinds of ways. So it's not a one size fits all. And that makes it harder for the sort of consumer to figure out like what they're getting. But I do think that that's actually going to be a real part of how delivery of education is going to happen. But I do think that, you know, there are some schools like a Wake Forest who are really known for the in-person experience. And that is like what it's all about. And that's sort of what you're really paying for, is those relationships and that experience. And so will there be some online in that environment? Maybe so, but I don't think it'll be the focus at all. But I think there are other places where it's like, hey, we're going to be about all online because we can still deliver a great education. You can have a lot of flexibility. The price is going to be, you know, a lot more attractive. And I think that's going to be possible. I also think about the idea of it's going to be modularized in a way where people don't have to do it all like in a strict 4-year process. You might be able to do it faster. You might be able to break it up. You might be able to do it with working at the same time. So that too will create opportunities for more choice. So that is one of the things that I do think about a lot is choice in education is going to be better for the student. I think the student's going to have a lot of ways that they can look at it. And one of the things that I also see happening is that the corporate market is, and certain employers are going to find a way to be on the edges or in the middle of education in some way, whether it's in partnership with universities or whether they do it on their own. I do think that that's going to be an option for people, which again, too, will be positive as choice, but also it'll need to be regulated in a way to make sure that it's really high quality. But I do think that's also going to put a lot of pressure on universities to figure out like, so what do we do about that? Like, how do we actually work with employers or corporations in a way that actually makes sense? So I wish I could say it's going to get more clear, but I think it's going to be in some ways more confusing with more choices. But I do think it's also going to create more access for a lot of people. And I do think that is one of the things that the world would really like, which is to actually think about how do we make a system where it's more equitable, more accessible, isn't totally predicated on, did I get into the most selective school that costs the most amount of money, that has the most elite networks? I do think that that's actually a positive thing. For career services in particular, I think that that particular function is going to continue to be super important, but I don't think it has to continue to look the way that it has historically. In fact, if you really think about it, the more that it actually gets more integrated into the dean's office or the provost's office, the more that actually there's a clear like team of people ranging from admissions to the academic side to the alumni side, mm-hmm. that's all really sort of tightly connected. I think that's going to be positive because I think historically people thought of career services as this is just an extracurricular thing you do sort of after you get your degree. And so the students in their mind sort of said, well, I just do this on if I have time. But I think the more that the schools say, wait, this is just part of the overall process, let's make sure it's integrated in the process, mm-hmm. that's going to be great. And I do think there are going to be a lot of ways to do it digitally so that it can be done at scale and you can reach every single student and it will be less about, I mean, will counselors and coaches be important? I think they'll still be important, but I don't think they'll be the only way to deliver the education that students can get because you can do a lot of it online.
Andy, we had exceedingly high expectations for this podcast, knowing who you are, and you've met every one of them.
Thanks, Brad. I appreciate that.
Tiffany, this has probably been a thrill for you, right?
It has been. You know, we've had thought leaders on VR, instructional design, MOOCs, but you are officially our career development person of Digital to Learn. So it's pretty exciting. We wouldn't want to have anyone else with us. So thank you so much.
It's been really wonderful to be with you. These are great topics, and you guys are exploring really important things about the future of education. I'm hoping that all the listeners out there will just be inspired to continue to challenge themselves to be courageous. Yeah, be comfortable with the uncomfortable and believe actually the future is as much as it's going to be like uncertain and challenging, that it'll be good. I think that actually we a lot of it is about having the right attitude and perspective and finding a way to make it work and working with other people to do so. So I'm really hopeful for what the future holds for all of us.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
You can catch Andy Chan's TED Talk and follow-up talk on our website, www.digitaltolearn.com, and that's a numerical 2. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are 3 things we ask you to do. 1, come back and join us again. 2, tell your friends about us. And 3, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.